scripture tonight. I'll read the very last verse of 1 Corinthians 12 and the very first verse of 1 Corinthians 14. What am I leaving out? Oh, we'll talk about that later. 1 Corinthians 12, 31b. And yet, I will show you the most excellent, what? Way. 1 Corinthians 14, 1a. Follow the way of love. Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. Imagine that you just bought a 12-pack of Coke. Each virgin can sits before you bubbling with the promise of caffeinated, carbonated, carbohydrate-rich pleasure. You remove the first can from the cardboard box and pop it open. You lift the can to your lips, but the liquid tastes salty and foul. Shocked, you throw it away and open the second can. You take a sip and immediately, you spit it out. You should see how I spelled that. It tastes like spoiled milk. You open a third can, and this time you lift it cautiously to your lips, but you don't drink. The smell of carbonated sewage disgusts you. If the fourth and fifth cans can greet you with the scent, if you can believe this, of gasoline and vinegar, how likely would it be that you'll open the sixth through the 12th cans, each of which, by the way, has the classic sweet, velvety, tongue-tingling taste you were expecting. Now, imagine you call Coca-Cola customer service and you share with them your experience. Customer service, Coca-Cola World Headquarters, how may I help you? You say, I just bought a 12-pack of Coke that tasted terrible. Customer service says, I'm sorry to hear that, but if you'll pause just for a minute and answer a couple of questions, that will help me to better serve you. What color were the cans? You say, well, the cans look normal. Bright red and white lettering. Customer service says, well, that's the most important thing. Was the cardboard box good and sound? You know, the box that contained the 12 cans. You say, well, yes, the cardboard box was fine. It was the taste that was the problem. Before you can say problem, they say, thanks for calling. I'm glad the cans were red and the box was sturdy. Enjoy Coke and have a nice day. And they hang up. Now, a brand like Coke only has meaning because it's linked to the essential quality or qualities for a soft drink. Taste, not a can. With a politician, policies, effectiveness, and character count, not hairstyle or skin color. You, with a bicycle, speed, weight, and comfort are paramount, not the color necessarily, though I have been known to pick one color of bike over the other. I look more sporty on a red bike. Thanks for the picture, right? And what are the qualities of the Christian faith? Let me ask you, that really matter regardless of the packaging. What would it mean for Christians to rediscover their faith not as a problematic system of beliefs, but as a just and generous way of life rooted in contemplation and expressed in compassion that makes amends for its mistakes and is dedicated to beloved community for all? Could Christians migrate from defining their faith as a system of beliefs to expressing it as a loving way of life? Could Christians let go the bitter tastes of colonialism, exclusion, judgment, hypocrisy, and oppression, and regain the sweet, nourishing flavors of justice, joy, and peace? Now, these opening paragraphs I just read you word for word, I wish I could say they're my own, but were written by Brian McLaren and used in the early pages of his book entitled The Great Spiritual Migration, in which he wrestles with why so many people are leaving church as we know it. His answer is so basic that you may prefer to overlook it. But I agree wholeheartedly with what he is suggesting. The church has abandoned love as a way of life that defines who we are and what we do. I don't just mean our church. I mean the church with a capital C. You have to have been around the church, not just this one, but church with a capital C, for a while to catch what I did. I alluded to it and hinted at it in this selection of the scripture lesson for the message. I read the last half of the last verse before 1 Corinthians 13 and the first half of the first verse after 1 Corinthians 13. And that little thing, chapter 13, has become pretty well known. Especially, I think, many weddings try to put a patent on 1 Corinthians chapter 13, so much so that it's been called the love chapter. It's been hijacked a bit for weddings. I like it. I've used it there many times myself. So what's wrong when we hear the word love repeated in that chapter where Paul really lays out a beautiful, poetic, moving symphony of words and stanzas? We assume that Paul's talking only about romantic love, and it works for that application. But love is to be the primary defining characteristic of the church and our everyday way of life. Christian leaders from all denominational stripes have always preached love, but in the last 30 or so years, there's been a concerted effort to call the church back to a way of radical love. Richard Rohr, Catholic priest, theologian, author, recently said, "Christianity is a lifestyle." He went on to say, "a way of being in the world that is simple, shared, and loving. However, we made it into an established religion and all that goes with that, and avoided the lifestyle change itself. One could be warlike, greedy, racist, selfish, and vain in most, I would add sexist, in most of Christian history, and still believe that Jesus is one's, quote, personal Lord and Savior. The world has no more time for such silliness. The suffering on earth is too great." Speaking of suffering, I cannot imagine what this past week was like for those of you, particularly women, and particularly women who are survivors of sexual abuse or misconduct. And while it is unfortunate that Dr. Blasey Ford's testimony came during the hearing this past week to the forefront during the hyper-partisan machinations of what Republicans and Democrats almost always do to one another to some degree during a Supreme Court nomination proceeding, I have literally been sick to my stomach at how many people I know to be self-professing Christian people who have allowed their partisanship, their loyalties to their own political party, to taint basic human decency, and not just towards the one providing the testimony of her story, but how men, self-professed Christian men in particular, have displayed an incredible lack of empathy and love. This past week, from my years as a pastor, I witnessed two self-professing Christian men, for example, whose daughters I know 100% because of having been in the ministry and been their pastor, were sexually abused. And these two men were so loyal to their own partisan politics that they were sharing degrading memes about Dr. Blasey Ford while their own daughters had suffered at the hands of abusers. God help us if this is what it means to be Christian. That we sell out to our partisan politics. All for what? If that's how it's going to be, if that's what it means to be Christian, we need to shut this place down. Do something else. About 10 years ago, authors David Kinnaman and Gabe Lyons outlined research of the Barna Group with hundreds of young adults under the age of 30 who were turning away and admittedly leaving the Christian faith. And they didn't explore the theological reasons, but instead they focused on the perceptions that non-Christian young adults have of Christians. And here's what they found. They said, "I'm leaving," and here were the reasons, the top reasons. 91% of those young adults said Christians were anti-homosexual. 87% felt Christians were judgmental. 85% felt Christians were hypocritical. 75% felt Christians were too political. 70% thought Christians were insensitive or uncaring. Amazingly, in these conversations with non-Christian young adults who had admittedly said, "Church is not for me, I've had enough," when they were asked a positive question, I think they pretty well nailed this. They said, "Well, based on what you know and your experience, what did Jesus stand for and what should the church stand for today?" And over 90% nailed it. Love. Love. If you came to this sermon today in expectation of me offering 3 magical silver bullets to fix the church forever, you'll be sorely disappointed with what I have to say next. It's far more difficult. I think it's far more complex than, 13 laws of love that will fix any church. We don't need to be more focused anyway on institutional preservation. That's how we got in this mess. The church has become so worried about our future, our own future, about emptying pews, about shrinking budgets, and the fact that most churches are in decline, that we have forgotten our main job in the world is to love the world and give ourselves away. As the great Dietrich Bonhoeffer put it, the church is only the church when it exists for others. The love God calls the church to offer the world is not narrow. It's not small. It's expansive. It knows no borders or boundaries. It can't even be contained in the word Christian. Jewish rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks describes how faith has always been expansive, about expansive love, in his book, I Love, Radical Then, Radical Now. Here's what he said about love. He said, "It's easy to love our neighbor. It is difficult to love the stranger. This is why the Torah commands us only once to love our neighbor, but on 36 separate occasions commands us to love the stranger. A neighbor is one we love because they are like us. A stranger is one we are taught to love precisely because they are not like us." That is the Torah's repeated and most powerful command. I believe it to be the greatest religious truth articulated in the past 4,000 years. Now, one of the greatest challenges I face, now listen to me whine, as a pastor, is getting people in churches to love expansively, even people who know up here what it means to love. Because in practice, it can become something else. At church, we talk about loving people of all skin colors. But the truth is, many of us do not know very many people of color, and therefore cannot properly love people of color if we do not run in the same circles as people of color. We cannot possibly advocate for people of color if we really don't know what it is they say they need. We can study it, but we can't learn it until we've earned the right to call some of them friend and understand their lives. It's the same way when we speak out on any single issue for any single marginalized people group. If we want to advocate for any person, for any group of people who are marginalized, be it LGBTQ community, be it persons of color, be it people that are in poverty, be it of women or different situations, we must know them. And if we desire to see positive change, to love others, those who are different from us, and to advocate for them, we must know who they are. We must know where they live. We must know what matters to them and what they think love looks like, not what is easy or convenient or cool for us. As Thomas Merton once said, and if you get nothing else, take this home. Love seeks only one thing, the good of the one loved. We must never, as a church, love others so that our own membership will grow. If our membership grows, it must be a side effect for the ways that we have engaged in selflessly loving others with no strings attached. And just so we're on the same page here, I want to make doubly sure you don't hear me just say this and just tune it out. Love is the answer. Just love. Love, love, love. It's the answer. Oh, it feels good. Just love when it, you know, feels good. That's fine. But no, in fact, I'm suggesting if we love as Jesus loved, that it will make us some friends, but it will also make us some enemies. It won't be our choice if we're loving the right way. But when you stand with those who have no legs, and when you speak for those and with those who have no voice, you make friends and you make enemies. Jesus took the side of the marginalized. He took sides. Every single time. He took the side of the marginalized. He took the side of the forsaken, the forgotten, the one who could not walk, the one who could not speak. He took the side of the outcast, the ones mainstream society shunned and said, they don't matter as much. Jesus took the side of the poor. He took the side of the women. He took the side of the sick. He took the side of the lonely, the lost, the underdog. That's who he took. And he didn't take their side to make a point. He took their side because love always stands with those who have no one. Love always stands with those who have no legs to stand on. Those who choose to stand with the rich, the favored, the ones who can make it all on their own, they do so because they hope to gain something in return. But the church, when the church gets it right, never loves someone because of what we think we can get out of it. We recall that Jesus said, those who try and save their life will lose it, but those who give it away will find it. Now, it was just one sermon, just like tonight is just one sermon. Some of you are saying, yeah, let's get it over with. But last week was just one sermon. And it wasn't the best sermon, I'll say. But I think it was different enough from what normally hits the airwaves, especially in Oklahoma. Basically, all I did all week long was counsel with people. I took phone calls. I answered emails. Both here and at my church in Weatherford. People wanted to talk about it and see if it could possibly be true that there's a church here in this community that celebrates LGBTQ people. And don't do it perfectly, but try our best to do it equally as we celebrate every other human being. I even had a mother drop in on me at my church in Weatherford during the week. And she asked me if I thought her daughter would be banished to hell forever for loving another woman. And I said, what? She fell on the floor of the office there at the church, sobbing. I cried with her. And then I had an invitation to go meet with a group of students, college students, LGBTQ college students. And I went to show love and solidarity, and I was amazed at the program that they ran, educating people, expanding people's horizon. And afterwards they said, well, some of us know, but some of us don't. Old guy. Yeah, old white bald guy in the back, would you introduce yourself? I said, I guess that's me. And so I did, and I said, you know, I'm just here to show love and support on that side of things. If you struggle, I'd be happy to talk with you. I sure don't have the answers, but I've got two ears. I know how to listen. And by the way, if you ever meet that special someone and you want to get married, I'd be honored to do it. Apparently that was a thing that floored them. And this old white bald guy got a standing ovation for something so simple to me. I didn't deserve it. I didn't let it get too much to my head, don't worry. But the world is starving for unconditional love. And Jesus left us here to supply it. That's what it is to be church. That's what Jesus modeled. It's why we're here. And love will cure whatever ailments or shortcomings both the church and the world may have. We can love our way right out of the mess we've gotten in. I believe that. Do you all remember the sermon that Reverend Michael Curry, Bishop of the Episcopal Church, gave recently at, well, at least the last royal wedding I could keep up with? His sermon was called, guess what? The Way of Love. Let me close with an excerpt. He says it a lot better than I can. Imagine our homes and families where love is the way. Imagine neighborhoods and communities where love is the way. Imagine governments and nations where love is the way. Imagine business and commerce where love is this way. Imagine this tired old world where love is the way. When love is the way, unselfish, sacrificial, redemptive love. When love is this way, then no child will go to bed hungry in this world ever again. When love is the way, we will let justice roll down like a mighty stream and righteousness like an ever-flowing brook. When love is the way, poverty will become history. When love is the way, the earth will be a sanctuary for all. When love is the way, we will lay down our swords and shields down by the riverside to study war no more. When love is the way, there's plenty good room for all of God's children. Because when love is the way we actually treat each other, well, we treat each other like we're actually family. When love is the way, we know that God is the source of us all, and we are brothers and sisters, children of God. My brothers and sisters, now that's a new heaven, a new earth, a new world, a new human family. So, what are we going to do about this mess? The church has become. The church has become this mess because we've forgotten that love is our business. We've forgotten that love is our language. We've forgotten that love is what gives us life. Love is what gives us credibility. Love, not the style of music, not how cool the preacher is, thank God. But love is what gives us relevance. Love is the only hope for the world and the only hope for the church. And we must give love and we must advocate with love for those who are cut off from anything less than full and complete equality. And we must lovingly fight for the inherent dignity of each and every human being. And we must do so not in the label of partisan politics, but in the name of love. All for the sake of a world where everyone is someone that matters and matters equally because true love demands it. And I believe when we lose ourselves in loving fully, we might even love our way out of the mess we've made at church. So in closing, may your love grow legs. And may your love walk you across the street, across the classroom, across the boardroom. May it lead you to stand beside those who have been told their lives are worth less than others. May love lead you to go intentionally to build relationships with people of color, with LGBTQ people, with those who are poor, with even with grumpy old white straight preachers, and people who are vastly different than you. Heck, maybe even a Republican or Democrat. May your love grow legs that will take you beyond the boundaries you've ever known, the comfort zones you've ever enjoyed, and the familiar faces you have little trouble loving as well. May we rediscover the most historic Christian way of living, which is loving wholeheartedly, but in new and fresh expressions for this century. May we, the church, reclaim the faith for love, radical, courageous, inclusive love. And may we hold nothing back, loving lavishly, wastefully, even unselectively. For when we love this way, the church more fully becomes what it was always intended to be, a conduit through which God's love flows into the world. Well, that's you. That's me. That's the church when we get it right. In the name of God, who is love.